From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at the weekend news, politics, and more. Coming up.
After years of close votes, Arkansas Republicans give a go-ahead on Medicaid expansion.
In Washington, Congress wraps up the year passing a bill funding the federal government through next September.
Another conflict over state and local control regarding Pulaski County schools.
Republican presidential candidate Ted Cruz returns to Arkansas this coming week as his poll numbers rise.
Little Italy makes a case for becoming Arkansas's next town, but will water stand in the way?
And a $500,000 grant will start restoration of Arkansas's second oldest bridge that's still standing. That's coming up on this week's KUAR Weekend Review podcast. Well, Jacob, there's been a lot of talk about this since Governor Hutchinson came into office, the future of the so-called private option, which was worked out as a compromise. Previous Governor Mike Beebe was able to create this along with some Republican members of the Arkansas legislature as a way for Arkansas to get some of the money that came from the Affordable Care Act, but use it in a unique way. The governor appointed a task force to study this, and this week the panel released a report, and we also had Governor Hutchinson speak to the committee.
And a lot of Republicans swept into power last November, promising to kill the private option, calling it part of Obamacare, something that's inseparable, because the Affordable Care Act decided that people making up to 138% of the poverty level should be provided government-subsidized insurance. So the legislature in last session, they voted to kill the private option, have it be phased out by 2017. A lot of legislators saw that as a victory of killing Medicaid expansion, killing Obamacare. The governor formed this task force, led in part by his nephew, the Senate Majority Leader Jim Hendren, and their decision, echoing exactly what the governor's request was, the governor's recommendations ended up being the task force recommendations, was that we really have to continue coverage for these 250,000 people on Medicaid expansion. One, because they thought it was morally appropriate to continue coverage, and two, is because it actually saves the state money since the federal government is paying for right now 100% of the cost. But Asa Hutchinson acknowledged that as Republicans, it doesn't always fit squarely with what other Republicans have done with Medicaid expansion.
If you look at other southern governors and other southern states, the position that I took was contrary. The position that I took bared some political risk, but at the same time, I saw it as the right thing to do for Arkansas. And I know that you are evaluating all of this in the same light.
And State Senator Terry Rice is one of those who vigorously opposed the private option in its original incarnation in 2013. He says that the governor wants to rename this as Arkansas Works. He sought some waivers and some adjustments, and that's one of the big things that came out of the task force, is the governor wants federal officials to approve Arkansas requiring work referral training, not requiring beneficiaries to work, but to be referred to work, to try to shift people into employer-based coverage when possible, and for the richest people of this low-income population to pay some small premiums. But Senator Terry Rice says he might like some of the changes for this Arkansas Works, but to him, it's still just Obamacare.
I have not supported Obamacare. I have opposed the private option. I think it will collapse in time. It would be an improvement to what came out of Washington, D.C., but I wouldn't say it works for me.
I will note that for this task force to endorse these recommendations, to tell the governor to go forward to Washington to seek the waivers for this Medicaid program, there was a voice vote and it was unanimous. No one said no, even though several people did afterward, like Senator Rice. And in the Senate, it just takes 9 senators out of 35 to kill this thing. So we'll see what happens really in April when the governor comes back with the waivers. We'll see what is approved, what is not approved, and there'll be a special session to finally get the final vote on this. But I asked Governor Hutchinson, after he gave remarks to the task force, about taking what is essentially Affordable Care Act money. How can he do that as a Republican?
You know, everybody thinks it's inconsistent to oppose Obamacare at the national level, but then participate in Medicaid expansion. You can make that argument if you wish, but obviously if they do away and make changes with Obamacare at the national level, then they're going to have to find replacements and solutions to address
what all the states are doing and give more flexibility to states. So,
the replacement to include Medicaid expansion funding.
We're dealing with the cards that have been dealt to us, and right now it is the Medicaid expansion population in Arkansas under the framework that the previous administration gave me. We're making the best decision for Arkansas right now. If Congress makes different decisions, we will deal with those circumstances at that time. Thank you all.
Do you have any follow-up questions?
Representative Joe Farrar is a Republican, a Tea Party legislator. He's one of the people who used to be known for opposing the private option the most. I spoke with him afterward, though, and he said kind of the same thing as the governor, that some of the hot-button waiver requests that they've wanted in the past, he's kind of come to terms with that at least this administration just won't approve some of the reforms that they want, because the deal is this is Medicaid funding from the federal government, so any state plan needs to have the same kind of rules that Medicaid would have in terms of quality coverage.
It's just what we can get right now. If we had a strong conservative Republican president now, we went in there and said, okay, Mr. President, conservative president, we want this population to be drug tested. We want this population to have jobs. We want this population to A, B, C, and D. And we got that. Great. But we don't have that option right now. We got a president right now, so let's do that.
So that's the Medicaid portion of the task force. The other big thing is Hutchinson has two conditions. One is these waivers that we mentioned for the Medicaid expansion. The other one is looking at the traditional Medicaid program, which is even bigger. Hutchinson argues that the state needs to find $835 million in savings to help pay for this private option expansion, although the Stephen Group report notes that the private option by itself saves the state money, even if you don't have these sort of reforms. But I spoke with the Democratic minority leader, Michael John Gray, who said, you know, he's very pleased that they got Medicaid expansion passed. It's something that's been an uphill battle every single other session, but it seemed relatively easy so far. But he said for these $835 million in cuts, they didn't really decide on how they're going to get there. It's going to be managed care, patient-centered medical homes, something like that. That's the big battle going forward.
We're going to take away quality of life, or if you're going to suffer because you're poor, or not connected, or maybe because you have a child that's developmentally disabled, is that savings worth it? So I think it's not we're questioning the math, more of how we get to that total. And rationing health care is probably, it's not what the governor wants to do, and I don't think that's what anybody wants to do.
So the task force is done meeting after 20-plus meetings for the year. They're going to come back in January after the governor gets time to talk with federal officials. But private option ends at the end of 2017, so the legislature will have to have a replacement plan if they want to keep covering these 200,000 people.
And the governor has to negotiate with the federal government to make this happen. Any indication or suggestion whether or not what's being proposed is likely to get federal approval?
Yeah, and the most interesting thing about these recommendations is how they've changed from the governor's initial suggestions a few months ago. He had a lot of more punitive measures, saying if you didn't pay your small premium, then we'll lock you out of coverage for 6 months, maybe. He had ideas of having asset testing. If you have a certain amount of money and assets, then you can't get coverage. He thought about having lifetime caps on benefits. You can't stay in the program for more than a certain number of years. And he kind of toned down those expectations when he presented to the legislature, calling them aspirational waivers. And he said he kind of characterized it as a beginning. He says, we're going to start to push for these things. The federal government has showed different levels of flexibility in the past. So maybe a future administration, maybe Ted Cruz or something, would approve these kind of changes. But the three main ones, the employer-based care, shifting to that, small premiums for the wealthiest in this low-income group, and work referrals, but not work or not requiring work, those he thinks will pass because they have in other states.
And you've sat through several of these hearings this week at the Capitol about this. Any indication what this would do to the people on, say, the private option? Right now, obviously, more hurdles that they'd have to jump through. But would this reduce the number of people eligible, or any kind of real analysis yet on what this would mean for these people?
You know, I haven't seen any data that said X amount of people will be on the program or not be in the program if we have these changes in terms of waivers. The governor and Republicans argue, though, that changing it from the private option to ASA, or not to ASA Care, but to Arkansas Works, that in itself is symbolic, that they want people to move off of the program. They want them to make enough money to not have to get this coverage, but hopefully with things like worker training referrals, then maybe someone would get a job and make more money and get off the program.
Well, we had a final burst of action in Washington as Congress wrapped up the year with action that will enable the federal government to be funded through next September. The Senate Friday approved a $1.1 trillion funding bill that's paired with nearly $700 billion in tax breaks. And as we record this, the package is on its way to the president's desk for his signature. The Senate adopted the Omnibus Appropriations Bill by a vote of 65 to 33. The House did so by a 316 to 111 tally. This was vital to prevent a government shutdown. It also includes a few key policies, including one that strengthens cybersecurity, renews the health care program for 9/11 responders, and ends a 40-year ban on crude oil exports. It also makes changes to the visa waiver program. Now people who've traveled to Iran, Iraq, Sudan, and Syria in the last 5 years will face higher scrutiny if they wish to return to the U.S. Hardline conservatives also lost their fight to include language in the bill, pausing the Syrian refugee resettlement program. While Arkansas's congressional delegation is entirely Republican, their votes were mixed. Congressman French Hill of the 2nd District here in central Arkansas voted for it, though he told me earlier in the week that he did have some reservations.
It's a mixed bag. You know, there's some things that we've gotten done in this first 11 months that I'm pleased with and a lot that I remain frustrated about. But getting funding in place for our national security and for our nation's priorities is an important step, and one we'll take this week.
What are you frustrated about?
Well, I think we still approach the funding challenges of this country with a lot of creativity. We still are spending a lot of money without putting a lot of creative thought in how we can reduce federal spending and send those priorities back to the states and give the states more leeway in how they do skilled workforce training or provide health care. And I believe that would reduce federal involvement and federal strings attached and the level of overall federal spending while improving people's lives at home. And so that's a theme I'm in constant work on in my job in Congress, is focusing on how can we get more bang for our buck for the hardworking taxpayers' dollar.
Congressman Rick Crawford of the 1st District in Northeast Arkansas voted against it. I spoke with him on Wednesday, and at that time, he said he was unsure about how he would vote and that his staff was still going through the agreement.
Well, there's an awful lot of good things in there, and I'm really trying to see that and get to a point where I can say yes, but there are a couple of sticking points that may override that, and we're doing some due diligence to make sure that we're right on this. And that's ultimately, you probably know I have a history of voting against these types of things, and I want to be consistent. I'm not saying no out of hand. Under other circumstances, I might have dismissed this readily without even having looked at it. But we've got new leadership. I think we're going in a new direction. At least I hope we're going in a new direction. But the proof of the pudding is under the crust, and so we're lifting up the crust and taking a look. And we want to make sure that before we take a bite of this, that we've looked at all the ingredients.
And in a statement Friday, Crawford said, the reason he ended up voting against it was because the omnibus package breaks budget caps with $50 billion in new spending, which he said adds to our nation's debt at a time when the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates on that debt. He acknowledged the bill did include several policies that would help the nation move forward, but felt those policies did not outweigh the costs of increasing the national debt. And Chris, you've also been collecting responses from other members of Arkansas's congressional delegation, in particular Representative Westerman and Senator Cotton.
Right. They both sent out press releases and both also voted against the bill. Senator Cotton State's office sent out a release saying it was a rotten process that yielded a rotten result, and referred to some backroom negotiations that sped the passage of the bill along. He took issue with one provision that increased the number of foreign guest worker visas, and he said that that's in direct contradiction to a lot of domestic American workers who are looking for opportunities. It takes away opportunities from them. According to his office, Westerman took issue with the fact that it furthers funding of Planned Parenthood. Of course, we've talked about that on the podcast as a very divisive issue. And it also increased short-term funding for the U.S. Forest Service's firefighting budget, which is in direct contradiction to, or maybe indirect contradiction to, his Resilient Forests of the USA Act, which would increase funding levels, take away from that budget going towards firefighting and put it more towards thinning of forests and managing forests by the Forest Service. The bill also increased funding for the Delta Regional Authority, which is a federal-state partnership that serves 252 counties in the Mississippi Delta, including 42 counties in Arkansas, sponsoring economic development initiatives. And I spoke with Chris Mazengill, the director of that organization, and here's his response to the funding increase.
This will be the largest appropriation that DRA has ever seen. It would potentially total $28 million with additional dollars that we get, and that's the most that we've ever received. In fact, our authorization is only $30 million, and this is a significant appropriation for the DRA. We've been working for many years to build the foundation and the groundwork for that. And we're very appreciative of the congressional support. We're very appreciative of the senators and members of Congress in our footprint that have been very supportive of DRA's effort.
And one of the lobbying groups that really pushed for that increase in funding for the Delta Regional Authority was the Delta Grassroots Caucus, and their leader, Lee Powell, talked about kind of what initiatives would be funded.
This is a vote of confidence, obviously, in the DRA from the Congress, and we certainly hope the omnibus will pass. And the DRA does a good job of stretching their few dollars a long way, and they do infrastructure projects, job creation, training. Their Delta Doctors Program has placed over 100 doctors in the region. They disseminate information about best practices in community and economic development.
So obviously that organization is pretty happy. They were founded in 2000 with, like Mazengill said, authorization cap of $30 million. But for the most part in the 2000s, their budget was around $10 million. So they're pretty happy about that.
So doubling their budget, essentially. Did they say anything in particular what this would go toward, or would it continue more of the kind of projects that Lee Powell mentioned there?
Yeah, they wouldn't be. I asked them about, you know, whether or not they'd be funding new projects, but essentially what they're saying is that these will go to fund their existing projects. And they kind of combine efforts with private entities to fund, you know, whatever infrastructure projects or, you know, business development kind of things. So.
Well, Jacob, this omnibus bill now is already kind of getting into the fight for the U.S. Senate. Senator John Bozeman obviously up for re-election in the coming year. He put out a statement after voting against this bill. He kind of reiterated some of what Rick Crawford said, saying this was a setback to efforts to control federal spending. Also said it does little to provide regulatory relief for Arkansas farmers, small businesses, and community banks while continuing to fund what he called the worst of the Obama administration's overreach. You also have reaction from his primary opponent, as well as the Democrat who is going to be running.
Yeah, so Bozeman's got two different people to worry about, politically at least. Curtis Coleman is trying to run to Bozeman's right. He's a more of a Tea Party type candidate than Bozeman has been. Curtis Coleman, of course, garnered about 20 or 30%, I think, in his run against Asa Hutchinson for governor. And Coleman sent a release actually before the vote, and he said, if Senator Bozeman votes no this year and needs to explain what is different from last year, other than the fact he knows that I am running and that voters are watching. And Connor Eldridge, the Democratic challenger who's raised quite a bit of money so far, he said something very similar. He said after the vote, he said, now Senator Bozeman is changing his stripes, but it won't fool Arkansas voters. And for Eldridge, it's kind of odd for him to say this kind of criticism about Bozeman, because most Democrats would characterize a no vote on this as some sort of a shutdown vote or some sort of extreme vote. But here's Eldridge saying that, Bozeman in the budget process is secretive, that it doesn't cut enough money for him to justify this bill. Some interesting facts, though, about the actual budget bill. According to PolitiFact, at least, since Obama's been president from 2009 to now, the deficit for every year has gone from $1.4 trillion to around $486 billion. So we've gone from about 9.8% deficit spending to about 2.8%. So it's good to keep those kind of facts in mind that while, yes, the deficit is still growing, it's a much different rate than when President Obama took office.
Well, on to another matter. Sarah, this week, Arkansas legislators discussed a possible return for the Pulaski County Special School District to local control. This comes as it nears its fifth year under state control. The decision, though, is complicated by a federal desegregation order. You were at the hearing on Monday. What's being talked about here?
The Pulaski County Special School District is coming to the end of it 5 years since it was taken over the state by state control, and it's time for the state board to reevaluate whether it should be returned to local control, which would give the district a school board, a joint subcommittee on desegregation litigation oversight reviewed this issue because some lawmakers are concerned that the district won't be returned to local control and that that won't be decided fairly. So they're sort of pressing Superintendent Jerry Guess, who's really been at the helm of navigating the desegregation requirements of the court order. That's a decades-old case and involves various categories that the district has to get up to standards for equality, including facilities, staffing, student achievement, and several other areas. So they were asking him about circumstances he might present to the state board to extend his leadership and keep state control in place. So Superintendent Guest said that one reason he might ask for an extended period to run the district is that there have been several unexpected circumstances that have come up in the past year, one being the timing of the end of segregation funding, which he's going to have to compensate for. Also, the separation of Jacksonville by popular vote from the Pulaski County Special School District, meaning that his district is losing the funds from those individual students. Here's what he said he'll be confronting when he tries to make a budget for the next year.
Mr. Woods has no budget to base his 16-17 operation on. There's never been a detachment. We don't have a budget to base our 16-17 on without those 4,100 or 4,200 kids. So both of those are tremendous challenges in our business. And we got a lot of people working very hard to think about every little minute detail and every nuance. But I can still tell you that July 1, 2016 is going to be a long day.
Right.
It'll be interesting to see when we get there.
Co-chair Senator Linda Chesterfield, this is her district that he's talking about, said it's been too long and that there needs to be local control. There needs to be a school board in place for residents to be making decisions about what's going to happen. And the district tried to ask for a millage increase for a facilities plan that was a part of the desegregation plan to get out of this court order, and that was denied by voters in the last year. So lawmakers talked about the very few number of people who voted in that election and why, and then that was sort of thrown around, and then they spoke about the number of people who vote in any election statewide and that not being a significant question about whether that was a, you know, basis for the deciding that local control was constitutional. But the issue comes down for her to the question that, you know, pleading special circumstance was not there's no basis for her, given that the district had known that Jacksonville was possibly separating. This has been like a many years question. And then beyond that, the desegregation funding loss, many year question. So she's saying there's really no reason to stop the democratic process any further.
We have met today because we're looking at desegregation litigation. I submit to you that it's going to be very difficult to get anybody to vote for anything of which they do not feel a part. Whether they should or should not, when people feel a part of something, they invest in that something. I have now not felt a part of the Pulaski County Special School District for 5 years because I don't keep up with when they meet, because it doesn't matter what I say. They're basically able to do whatever they want to do. I think it's time for the citizens of Pulaski County to get their district back. I think it's time to rebuild the confidence that what we say and what we do as citizens matters. So I would ask that as we look at set special circumstances, I would repeat what Senator Elliott said, we deal with them every single day. And that we not use special circumstance as a reason to continue to disenfranchise the citizens of the Pulaski County Special School District. It is especially egregious because the junior district, the new district that I represent as well, already has a school board. They're making decisions already. It's the giving district. It is the district from which it has flown that still continues to have no voice.
So what happens next in this?
The state board's going to vote on whether to, well, the state board's going to review the district, and Superintendent Guest will have the opportunity to plead that he should have more time on the basis of this special circumstances permission. You know, these things sound Byzantine, but as we'll probably remember from last year, the fight over local control in the Little Rock School District gets to the heart of a lot of longstanding issues in this region, racial issues. You know, it's hard to pinpoint in a way. Representative John Walker has an ongoing lawsuit where he has these wide-ranging claims that there's inequality in the districts, and that's a federal suit. There was a divide down racial lines, I would say, in the conversation between all of the representatives who were encouraging Superintendent Guest, who's white, that there was a basis for a delay, and then the senators and Representative Walker, on the other hand, explicitly arguing that this is a Democratic issue and that there should be a return to local control.
I have a question about how the state board makes its decision. For certain things, like there's the state assessment for districts are in academic distress, there's some kind of database decision about when a school district gets control returned. But for this instance, what kind of benchmarks are they looking for? Or how arbitrary is the state board's decision?
The best I can answer that is that when this came up last year, I spoke to the then chairman of the state board, Sam Ledbetter, and asked him what the criteria for the takeover was. And he said, there's no criteria. It's a qualitative assessment, and it doesn't seem that there's discussion much so far at the state board about benchmarks for the Little Rock School District progress as after year one. So from my experience, it seems that it's not clear that there are very specific benchmarks beyond the role of this federal judge, Marshall, who's been reviewing the desegregation progress under Jerry Guess.
And the other question I have about that, with the loss of desegregation funding coming, are you saying that even though some school districts maybe haven't met their desegregation standards, they're still taking the desegregation funding away?
So
That was the, there was last year the federal, I might not know, the last year the federal suit was resolved, and I know that Pulaski County is a part of that, but they haven't resolved their desegregation requirements.
Right.
But then there's this issue of the facilities being their next goal in Pulaski County. They tried to get voters to support their financial needs there and weren't able to, so they've sold some bonds and they're still going to be able to build a high school. And then actually, surprisingly, the separation of Jacksonville has been helpful to both districts because Pulaski County wasn't going to be able to pay for those schools, and now Jacksonville will get some kind of state support based on their size. So they have a plan to move forward with those issues, but, you know, it's complicated.
Indeed. On to the presidential election campaign. We have Ted Cruz, a Republican candidate who's really been getting a lot of attention lately. He has even surpassed Donald Trump in polling in Iowa and has really been getting the backing of evangelicals. And he'll be coming back to Arkansas next Tuesday, speaking at a church over in North Little Rock. Jacob, you covered Ted Cruz when he was in town. He was in Little Rock.
Mm-hmm.
What was it, August?
Yeah, something like that. It's pretty early on. It was one of the first presidential campaign stops in Arkansas. There's maybe 400 or 500 people in the parking lot of the Republican Party of Arkansas headquarters near the Capitol. He'll be coming back to North Little Rock to speak at a church. I'm not quite sure about the size of that church, but in a recent straw poll conducted at the winter meeting of the state GOP, Cruz won the straw poll, beating Trump, Huckabee, Carson, Rubio. And also when I in that rally in the past when Cruz was here, I spoke with Bob Ballinger, who's a state representative who is known for a lot of trying to prevent local discrimination laws that would protect LGBT couples, something that is made that Huckabee has pursued hard. He did all those events with Kim Davis, the Kentucky clerk who wanted to deny marriage licenses. And he said that it's not that Arkansas Republicans don't like Huckabee, but he said pretty bluntly that he didn't think that Huckabee might even make it to the March primary. And this week we have some news. You covered a little bit of it with Alice Stewart, Huckabee's communications director, suggesting he doesn't have a good road ahead for the next few weeks.
Yeah, and she stepped down as his communications director. And this comes after she has been working with him since his time in the governor's office. And on Monday, without offering a lot of explanation, at least initially, she stepped down from that position. And Iowa was really the big hope for Huckabee. When he filed the paperwork at the Capitol to be a presidential candidate here in Arkansas, at that time, he said that, we're going to go to Iowa and we're going to win in Iowa, suggested that was going to change the momentum for him in this campaign, but that doesn't seem to be happening. And this week we had the Arkansas Times blog show a photo of Huckabee returning to Little Rock after Tuesday night's debate, apparently coming here for some medical procedures, but showed he and his wife Janet at the airport. Rather sad photo. No entourage helping him. He and his wife pulling their own bags, no crowd cheering him on, and Huckabee, after the recent surgery, walking with a cane. And it just, the comments were, this really seems symbolic to the status of his campaign in general.
Right, and with this undercard debate this week, he certainly did not generate any noise that I could tell of or any popular attention for anything he said. He's debating with people like George Pataki and Lindsey Graham, who have gotten almost 0% of the vote in most states. And Huckabee's own daughter said after Alice Stewart's departure, she also spoke with Politico, the same person that spoke with Alice Stewart, saying that some salaries have been cut for the existing staff and that if they don't get more than, say, 2% in Iowa, they're probably just going to call it quits there.
Yeah, and you mentioned that, yes, this is, I think, the second time now that Huckabee has not been allowed to participate in the primetime debate. So when he's not even being seen by a major audience that tunes in to this, that's really going to be difficult for him to turn things around.
In the state legislature, they also passed a bill that a lot of people saw as blatantly supposed to be helping Huckabee's campaign. They moved the state's primary from late in the season, one of the last states, to the Super Tuesday SEC primary with a number of other southern states. Ted Cruz has called it his southern firewall. Well, so has Mike Huckabee. Right now, it looks like Ted Cruz is going to win that firewall. But at this point, we'll see if Huckabee even gets to make it to there, to, you know, the ultimate end of some of these legislators' strategy.
Yeah, but it has still been rather volatile. Things have been changing quickly over the months in this campaign. So be interesting to see what happens next. Chris, this week, Little Italy, a community in northwest Pulaski County, leaders of a petition drive to incorporate this small community to become its own town, had a hearing. You were there. Tell me about this.
Yeah, the leaders of this incorporation drive, the citizens of Little Italy for incorporation, spoke to Pulaski County Judge Barry Hyde. Now, we normally think of our county judges as sort of mayors who preside over a quorum court, which is kind of like a city council. But in this role, Hyde more closely resembles a judicial figure in that he gets to decide whether or not incorporation can be granted. So he had a hearing. The leaders of this petition drive of this small community, about 350 residents just north of Lake Maumelle in Pulaski County, sits atop this place called Y Mountain. It's about an eight square mile region. They talked about their proposed city budget, which is a modest $75,000, would mostly take county and state turnback taxes to apply to city streets and law enforcement, things like that. Here is Chris Dorr. He's the leader of this petition drive. These were his opening remarks in front of Hyde.
Our incorporation will change the reality for our citizens, and this manifestation is one of our inalienable rights, access to civic participation. Your Honor, since the beginning of this incorporation movement, the citizens of Little Italy have been excited about this process. The possibilities of civic participation is something they hold dearly. It is evident in every step of the process. We've seen in Little Italy since we started this, something that is straight out of a Norman Rockwell painting, America at its finest. At several town hall meetings, residents actively asked questions. They offered their suggestions. They shared their hopes and frustrations with each other. During the petition drive, volunteers canvassed the area, talking to potential electors. They discussed the future, and they connected, for their mutual desire of local government was real and something that they wanted.
Now, there are implications for residents in the broader Central Arkansas region beyond this small community. Little Italy, as I mentioned, sits right next to Lake Maumelle. And the Lake Maumelle watershed was the subject of a zoning code that was passed by the Pulaski County Quorum Court in 2013. It was put on hold for about a year as they appointed a task force to kind of look at it and issue recommendations. Dorr was actually a member of that task force. This lake, of course, provides drinking water for 400,000 people in the region. Some groups are opposed to this incorporation. Chief among them is Central Arkansas Water, which, of course, is the main utility. I spoke with John Tynan after the hearing, and here's what he said.
Immediately upon incorporation, 5,000 acres of land that's currently protected by a number of county water quality regulations would no longer be subject to those. And a lot of time, energy, and effort has gone into establishing those protective water quality regulations, and losing those in one fell swoop would be a huge detriment to water quality protection in Lake Maumelle.
And the hearing was delayed. There was no decision. Judge Hyde had a scheduling conflict. He's going to schedule another hearing where we're expected to hear a presentation from Central Arkansas Water. Afterwards, in response to Tynan's remarks, I spoke with Dorr again, who I mentioned was a member of that task force that helped shape those zoning codes for the watershed. He said, you know, Central Arkansas Water had come to them with a compromise that was unacceptable, which was to drop the incorporation bid, become a historic district, They rejected that, and Central Arkansas Water came up with another compromise.
The second compromise that Central Arkansas Water offered was for us, without their aid, to attain 75% of the landowners and lien holders of that land to sign a covenant with them, saying that the individual landowner would be responsible for protecting it according to the zoning code. That was unfeasible. It just did not work as far as our abilities. These are local individuals who do not have the coffers of a large corporation. And for us to do that would not work with our time constraints, would not work, to go to individual landowners and lien holders and seek their signatures. It was not a compromise.
So Dorr and the other leaders of the petition drive say they have promised Central Arkansas Water that their town council, once it's elected, would adopt an ordinance that would mirror the zoning code. But of course, there's uncertainty there. That's part of the reason why Central Arkansas Water opposes it. There's no guarantee, essentially, that that zoning code would be mirrored. It's about a 25% of the watershed is Little Italy. So that's what's going forward. There could be, a court challenge. Judge Hyde's decision could be appealed to another judicial body, probably Pulaski County Circuit Court, and it's uncertain whether or not in 2016, Little Italy will be able to have its first election. But we'll have another hearing in front of the Pulaski County judge, and there will be a decision then.
And that's when Central Arkansas Water will make a case?
Yes, that's where they're expected to make a case.
You covered this meeting as the Pulaski County Administrative Building or something like that in downtown Little Rock. Can you give me a little bit of an idea of what Little Italy looks like? How many people are there? Do they have, a business district at all, or is it just pretty loose?
It's atop this place called Y Mountain. It's a rural community. It's about 350 residents, according to these petitioners. It was founded about 100 years ago. In fact, their 100th anniversary is coming up on December 23rd. People of Italian descent, there's a Catholic church there that has this famous annual spaghetti dinner. There's a daffodil festival that's held nearby. So mostly landowners who have a lot of land. There's a little hamlet section that's a little more dense with houses and stuff, but mostly farmers and like that.
So it really does have an Italian connection.
That's my understanding, yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, finally, we had an announcement this week, at least a formal announcement, that a $500,000 federal dollar grant will allow work to begin to restore what is the second oldest bridge still standing in Arkansas. This crosses the Saline River, and it's hoped that this will eventually become part of an extensive cycling and bicycle trail, or cycling and pedestrian trail, between Little Rock and Hot Springs. This is the Old River Bridge, built in 1891. It was a single-lane vehicular bridge and has not been in use since 1974, since its flooring was damaged at that time. And there's long been a desire to restore, to renovate this bridge. And this $500,000 grant will finally enable work to begin. This won't cover the whole cost of it, but this will cover a good bit of it. And there's a lot of excitement here. Right now, to describe the bridge, if you haven't seen photos, and we do have one on my story up on our website, KUAR.org, but the bridge, it essentially has two spans and looks fairly similar to the Junction Bridge that goes across the Arkansas River at Little Rock. Fascinating old bridge just outside of Benton. And Saline County Judge Jeffrey Airy noted during a ceremony on Monday its historic significance.
A couple hundred years ago, 1815, William S. Lockhart and his family settled on the banks of this river, right here at this Saline crossing. The crossing was a gateway to the Southwest, and that's where everybody came and to go to the Southwest part of the country. Later, some years later, in I believe 1831, Mr. Lynn Moore will correct me on my history if I'm not correct, but I think I'm close. He was Mr. Lockhart was actually licensed to operate a ferry that he operated for many years, and then sometimes later in around 1890, Saline County actually contracted with Youngstown, Ohio, to build this bridge.
And as he mentioned, this was part of the original Southwest Trail that pioneers heading west took. And that's what they want to name this cycling and pedestrian trail, name it the Southwest Trail. The plan is for cranes to lower the bridge to the ground in two pieces for work to be done. Piers supporting the structure will have to be replaced. We're talking about a 260-foot-long bridge. And this is Garland County Judge Rick Davis, who's hoping that this money to restore this bridge really will make this trail a reality.
The reason I'm here today is this is a great start to the dream of the Southwest Trail. You know, this was started kind of before Jeff got here with Judge Blinds and also Judge Fights. And so it's good to see this progressing forward, and that, like I said, this is a first step to the beginning, and hopefully we'll keep this movement going, and eventually we'll see the completion of the Southwest Trail from Hot Springs to Little Rock, and Benton and Bryant and all of them included. Yeah. So it's a good deal.
And the people he's referencing there, former Pulaski County Judge Buddy Valines and former Saline County Judge Lanny Fite, who had taken part in a press conference about 2 years ago that I covered, where they first announced plans for this. And say largely, this is based upon the success that you've seen elsewhere in these kind of bridges, especially the River Trail in Little Rock and North Little Rock. And it's also, this trail would incorporate abandoned railroad right-of-ways. And that's also been extremely popular around the country, converting these right-of-ways into trails, because partly they've already been graded. They usually have nice gradual curves and inclines, and are really ideal for cycling. So the hope is this would make it one of the more extensive trails here in Arkansas, and travel through what really is a very scenic part of the state. So with that, I guess we're wrapped up. We've been listening to KUAR's Weekend Review podcast. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
You can subscribe to the podcast if you're not already a subscriber on iTunes. KUAR is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Our theme song is by our own Chris Hickey. Thanks for listening.